Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Our guest today is no stranger to the podcast. This is the second in a series with Dr. Mark. And the last episode, we talked all about nutrition. So if you haven't heard that one, please take a couple minutes to listen to all of the great things he shared with us. I have instilled some new things in my routine since I learned from him that day. And now, a couple weeks later, he is back to talk about exercise. And I am so excited that our community can learn from you once again. So welcome back, Dr. Mark. I would love to talk about how you got into, so you are a physician. Your knowledge base is so wide, right? You know about mitochondrial disease, and you know about nutrition, and you know about exercise, and even sleep, which hopefully we're going to have you on the show again soon to talk about that. How did all this come together to create your career?
Yeah, it's a little bit eclectic. In school, I was doing football and track and downhill skiing and wanted to be on the national team for skiing. Trained my face off and was kind of mediocre. I then started to get a bit disillusioned and, you know, started running and lost 30 pounds and realized that, you know, my mitochondria were pretty good. So I got into orienteering, eventually made the national team throughout my career in undergrad. I wanted to be a phys ed teacher, so I did kinesiology and biology, made the national team for ski orienteering, went to Europe for some world championships, did a bunch of cross-country skiing, and always, you know, felt that exercise is important. After that, I did MD after that, and I decided I'm going to be a sports medicine doctor because I wanted to integrate exercise and sports. Yeah, did some rotations. Thought it was a little bit boring because, you know, it's just sports injuries mostly. So I got really turned on to nutrition through one of my professors in my undergrad years in kinesiology. And we started doing some work with a nutrition group. And so I decided to do a PhD in cell biology and metabolism in a nutrition group. So we were looking at, you know, protein requirements for top sport athletes, kind of bridging nutrition and exercise. During that time, I worked a day and a half in a neuromuscular clinic with Dr. Susan Goodwin, a neurologist. Got really excited about neurology. Finished, and then I did, you know, training for a year in internal medicine, and then did kind of a hybrid residency in neurology, and then I finished off my residency training also in physical medicine rehabilitation. So when I finished all of that, I was dealing with patients who have either muscle weakness and or mitochondrial dysfunction. So that's kind of the main group that I deal with, muscular dystrophy and mitochondrial disease. And when you think about it, our patients, you know, have either weakness or endurance issues or a combination thereof. And what's the best way to improve muscle strength and mass and resistance exercise? The best way to improve mitochondria is endurance exercise. So we looked at more common disorders so we could actually get funding, things like obesity, aging. And we did innumerable studies with the kinesiology department looking at the molecular underpinnings for how exercise adaptation occurs. And then started to blend nutrition in. You know, we know that exercise is good, but can we enhance the benefits of exercise? Which kind of, you know, gets to the whole health span, lifespan issue. Everyone's hand-waving about these, but really the only thing that improves your lifespan is better mitochondria through endurance exercise. That's the only strategy proven to extend our lifespan. And the only thing to improve our health span is strength and muscle function. So if you can't get out of a chair, you can't go up a flight of stairs, it impacts your health span. But we've really been interested in trying to optimize the ability to increase muscle strength and function and also to improve mitochondria. And applying this to patients, it just made so much sense. So, you know, that we're playing in that intersection between nutrition and exercise and trying to optimize people's health through that combination. So that's kind of where I got into these things. And it's pretty clear, too, there's no cure for any neurologic disease other than, you know, probably spinal muscular atrophy with gene therapy if we catch them in the first, you know, days of life. But beyond that, there's no cures. So we've always been interested in helping people, and these are the only strategies that have been proven time over time to be a benefit. Didn't get much attention or interest because people, you know, are always looking for a drug. They want a single hit. They think that magically they're going to cure disease. But I've been in this game for 30 years. We still don't have cures for almost everything that I see, but we have very effective treatments. Some of our patients with, for example, a glycogen storage disease, McArdle's disease or glycogen storage disease type 7, they live pretty much a normal life with optimization of nutrition and exercise with no drugs, no cure, but they are living completely normal lives with very careful attention to exercise and nutrition details.
I think you hit on some very interesting points. First, that you're at this intersection between like nutrition and exercise and understanding mitochondrial health. And I'm really curious if you're at that intersection alone, because I, you know, have been doing this podcast for a number of years, and it's very hard to find someone with your knowledge base. You know, I've wanted to dive more into nutrition and exercise, and, you know, it's been tough to find practitioners that really have that knowledge base of both. So I am so happy to have you. I mean, we have found a select few that have been incredible, but I think you're really in a league of your own with your background, and your passion for what you do is really incredible. And it comes forward. It's very easy to see as I talk to you. So I'm happy that you are now, let's say, a friend of the podcast, right? Let's talk about exercise. There's a lot to talk about here. And to me, I think the best place to start is like an issue that I have with myself is I'm scared to push myself. I often have, you know, that creates a negative impact on my body. I have chronic back pain. I have pain all through my legs, and sometimes a very simple workout can throw me into that flare up, and I'm scared, but I want to work out. So it's something I struggle with every day.
There's a few issues. Number one, anyone, able-bodied people, otherwise, you know, myself included, you know, you can push yourself into damage. You can damage a joint. You can push your muscles to what's called rhabdomyolysis, where you break down the muscle, which can be a life-threatening issue because you can damage your kidneys. So the point is, any person can overexercise. Any person can cause damage. So it is very important.
My level seems to be very low.
Yeah. But, you know, and when people tell me that their level's too low, I say, yeah, you know, give me a break. We know you can do it because of our experience. So we had a lady, for example, with myotonic muscular dystrophy type 1. And if you saw her, you know, it looks as bad as the most severe mitochondrial patient. Her feet were dropped down. She could barely lift her arms up as she, you know, limped her way into the clinic. She joined our endurance training study. When she first got on the bike, we had zero resistance, like just spinning the pedals with no resistance at all. She lasted 38 seconds. That was it. And she was pooched. So very carefully, gradually, we got her to the point that after 3 months of training, she was on the bike 3 times a week for 30 minutes. Her mitochondrial efficiency, i.e. her VO2 max, went up 50%, which is dramatic. Her ability to go upstairs.
How do you actually quantify that?
VO2 max is essentially the total activity of all your mitochondria in a human body in real time. So what we do is the room has 20.93% oxygen. We breathe that in. It goes into our lungs and eventually into our bloodstream. Our heart pumps it out. Our tissues then extract it. The extraction is largely a function, ultimately, of your mitochondria, which at complex 4, taking the food you eat and the oxygen you breathe to make energy. So when we breathe out the oxygen, the concentration of oxygen is lower. So the difference between the oxygen coming in and the oxygen that leaves, multiplied by the total volume of oxygen, is your VO2, or volume of oxygen consumed. So our patients with mitochondrial disease, usually, not all of them, but usually, especially Milas syndrome, have a very low VO2 max. And so increasing VO2 max allows you to participate in your daily activities at a lower threshold. So for some of our patients, if their VO2 max, which we've measured before, is really low, like under 10 milliliters per kilogram per minute, that's almost at the point of not being able to function in society. Those individuals, when they just get up and go to the washroom, they're almost at their maximal capacity. So every day is a struggle. So we can bump that up by 10 or 20 or 30%. And then you do the same absolute intensity, it represents a lower proportion of your total. So for this lady, what she found is things like going up 3 or 4 stairs, making dinner was much easier for her because now her threshold is higher, her VO2 max was up, and so her tolerability was much more. But was it easy? No. Did she have to start really low, like 38 seconds, spinning pedals with no resistance? But that was her maximum. And so, you know, for people who's, you know, think of an able-bodied person, you say, well, just go 3 times a week for 30 minutes. Most people are going to fail. Even sedentary people, it's going to be really hard for them. So I think the first point is, one, you've got to start at a really low level, whatever's right for you. Usually you should be able to converse and still carry on a conversation. Otherwise, you're probably pushing too hard from an aerobic perspective, and gradually increase. So it's critical to allow the body to recover. Exercise works through damage and repair. So yes, you are going to stress those muscles. The muscles might be a little bit stiff. You don't want to overdo it and cause damage. We'll talk about how to prevent that. Then you need a period of time for the muscles to recover. That requires sleep. It requires optimal protein. And it requires time, 24 to 48 hours before you exercise that muscle again.
Oh.
If you're still feeling that it's drained or fatigued, give it more time, work on a different muscle. So it doesn't mean that you're wasting time if you've done your legs and they're still sore 2 or 3 days later. You know, do something for your arms, for example. Now, another way of thinking about intensity, so we think about VO2 max or the percentage of your VO2 max or heart rate when we're doing endurance. When we're doing resistance, we think of your one repetition maximum. So the one repetition maximum is the maximum amount that you can lift. And most studies, generally, you're looking for around 70% of that maximum, and you're lifting that weight for a set. So a set would be, you know, 12 repetitions or 15 repetitions. But what we'd recommend is generally starting at about half of what your maximum would be. And the easy rule is if you can lift that weight 12 to 15 times, and, you know, it's getting tiring and it's tough. But if you can only lift it 3 or 4 times and then it's too much for you, then that weight is too high. So back off, drop the weight. You should be able to do 3 sets of 12 to 15 repetitions. And you should take at least 2 minutes between each set to allow the muscle to recover. So that's a very simple rule. Tanya Tabasalo, one of my colleagues who did the first, you know, really well done training study, followed a similar protocol in patients mainly with chronic progressive external ophthalmoplegia and showed impressive improvements in strength, just like what we see in older adults. So we've done this in myotonic dystrophy, Pompe disease, older adults with sarcopenia, obesity, and Tanya's done this in mitochondrial patients, both the resistance and the endurance, showing benefits. But really important to start off slow, listen to your body, give that 24 to 48 hours recovery. Ultimately, we do think that mixing things up is important. So a little bit of resistance, a little bit of endurance, at least, you know, 2 or 3 times a week of each, and spread them out. A couple of other things I would say is very important to find what you like, because if you don't like it, you're not going to do it. So if somebody told me to go and run on a road every day or to go into a pool, I'd rather shoot myself in the head. But cross-country skiing or trail running, I love it. And other people are the opposite. I know some people love, you know, the pool. And so you got to find what works for you and what you enjoy, number one, because there's at least 15, 20 different types of activity that would be perfectly fine for a patient to do from an endurance perspective. And weights are usually the most common type of resistance exercise that people are aware of. But, you know, there are other things, body supported activities and, you know, some Pilates machines that other people might find helpful from more of the resistance perspective. But again, start off slow, gradually ramp up, listen to your body. And most people can get there. But again, other things like if you've got a cold or a flu superimposed on it, take that day off. Wait till you feel better. Make sure you're well hydrated. You know, don't go into it if you've been fasting overnight. For most people, you're not going to feel very good. Make sure that you're well hydrated and your urine's fairly clear. If it's really dark urine, you're probably a bit dehydrated. Probably not a good day to work out. So those are some of the general principles. Another principle that we find is just taking MELAS as an example, because most people are familiar with that. Some of our patients have significant weakness, but they're okay from an endurance perspective. Others have horrible endurance, really low VO2 max, but their peak strength is pretty good. So I would suggest to play to your strengths. So if your endurance is really bad, maybe start off with a bit of weights because you're taxing a different energy system. Once your body gets used to it, then you can maybe titrate in or ease into a little bit of more of the endurance stuff to try and bump your capacity up so that your daily activities are a little easier for you. So those are a few of our tricks that we've learned over the years to help people to exercise safely.
So what are some ideas of how to do, like, of endurance type exercise that seems safe to you?
Well, all exercise is safe if done properly. So again, you know, you just got to start at a very low level, but you also have to think about other things. So for example, you mentioned you have back pain. If you are, you know, let's say running on a flat treadmill, that tends to put more stress on your back. So generally, if you wanted to take up running, or not running, even brisk walking, which is good for you, if the treadmill's tilted up a little bit, it tends to offload the back. So that's one strategy. Elliptical is well tolerated by most people because you get your arms and your legs in there and it's nice and stable. A lot of our patients have ataxia or balance issues. The things like a recumbent bike, which helps to stabilize your back. Elliptical, where you're holding on, would be a good strategy. But if somebody were to say, you know, get on a bike and drive down a, you know, a roadway with a bunch of cars, probably not the smart idea. So you've got to really adapt the activity to what the person enjoys and what's best for that individual and gradually ramp things up.
Hopefully this podcast, if you're listening, will just give you some time to really think about what that could be for you, you know, and, you know, listening to Dr. Mark talk about the importance of this all is hopefully going to incentivize people to come up with that thing, whatever that thing is for them, right? That type of activity that they can do regularly. Are you concerned about damage if someone is using weights that they can't, that like too high of a weight count?
Yeah, that's my whole point, though, is that if you can do three sets of 12 to 15 reps, you know, you're not going to cause damage.
But what if you think, what if it's tough for you, but you want to push through and you're telling yourself you can do it, but what if you really can't?
Well, if you, you know, if you grabbed a weight and it was heavier, then after three or four, and you say, "Whoa, I can't do another one," just stop. You're just doing three or four contractions, you know, you're not going to cause any damage. I think what people should think about, though, is, you know, having a trainer is important because, you know, a free weight, for example, not the best thing to start with. Machines are safer because you can't drop the stuff on your toe or whatever. Being with the trainer and saying, look, you know, my neurologist or Dr. Narfalski told me I want three sets of 12 to 15 reps. I want to start low, gradually ramp up. With a certified kinesiologist or trainer, they're going to totally be able to help you to work through. The other issue is if you don't do it right, you can cause back pain. If you don't do a proper bridge and you're not stabilizing your core properly, you can cause damage. But that's, again, it should never happen if people are following the proper instructions. And ideally, you know, even the first two or three, if you could do it with a certified trainer, you're going to avoid those injuries. Other things like walking, you know, little things like, do you have a zero drop in your shoe or a 7 millimeter drop, which is sort of the difference between the back of your heel and the front of your foot. That can make all the difference in terms of plantar fasciitis or, you know, knee pain and various other things. So there's so many nuances to exercising safely. But again, you know, you do need somebody who has experience. But certainly if you are finding that your feet are a little uncomfortable, you know, maybe see a podorthist, maybe think about orthotics, change your shoes, find the shoe that works best for you. Because just going out for a walk, brisk walk with your dog is amazing for most people. And it, for a lot of folks, is a good place to start. But you got to find something you enjoy. The other thing that I should point out, trekking poles. We're huge fans of trekking poles. My wife and I use them, even though, you know, I was an elite athlete at one point. I'm still training 7 days a week. But on the weekends, if we're doing a long hike, it just feels so nice to have the trekking poles. It gives you a bit of arm workout going up and down hills. And if you have ataxia, instability, weakness of your ankles, for example, the trekking poles will massively improve your stability, dramatically lower fall risk, and give you a better overall workout. Get good quality trekking poles and make sure that people in the store fit them for you so they're neither too short nor too high. People with back pain, it helps to offload some of the discomfort in your back. But certainly our patients with balance problems like ataxia, the trekking poles really can help you to get out and enjoy the outdoors without the fall risk.
Yeah, create some confidence in those patients, right?
Absolutely. You know, I remember 10, 15 years ago, I don't want a trekking pole because it's like a cane. But so many people are using it, like my wife and I use them on the weekends, and tons of people use it. And this Nordic walking is all the rage now. Lots of people are doing it, especially older adults. So you won't feel embarrassed using a good quality pair of trekking poles. You'll be kind of cool and groovy while you're lowering your fall risk.
I know you mentioned that the pool isn't your favorite place to exercise, but is it powerful enough for like a solid workout to you know, make these strides in our development and our muscle strength?
You know, the pool is a great place for many people if you like it. I just don't like it. And as I say, find what you like and go with it. Endurance, obviously doing laps is going to give you an endurance type of activity. There are weight programs that people do with different foam weights and stuff in the pool. You know, a lot of older adult programs, you know, use this. And the reason for that is, you know, if you fall and you're, you know, in a 2 feet or 3 feet of water, you're not going to hurt yourself. Be careful on your way to and from the pool if you have balance issues at all, of course. That's the only time it's risky. But once you're in the pool, it's very safe. And certainly, you know, one can do endurance or resistance in a water environment. Some folks really enjoy it. And, you know, it's very difficult to overdo it in the pool because it is supporting some of your body weight. But it's certainly something, if you enjoy it, yeah, it'd be a great activity.
I'm just curious, am I at a higher risk for damaging my joints?
No. So actually probably a lower risk because you're not pushing quite as hard as, you know, some crazy weekend warrior who goes out, you know, and does it. You know, the damaging your joints, be careful on trails if there's, you know, roots and rocks. We call it roots, rocks, and reggae. So, you know, trekking poles will help with that. Obviously, start off in a safer environment. In terms of repetitive strain injury, if you start really getting into, you know, running or hiking or whatever, make sure you've got the proper equipment. Make sure you change your shoes at an appropriate time. Orthotics if you have issues, like if you're knock-kneed, if you've got, you know, a flat foot, there's various other things that could benefit from orthotics. So those are ways to reduce those type of injuries. But in terms of muscle tears and strains and pulls and stuff, people are at no higher risk. But again, if you don't do the stuff properly, then yes, you can get a shoulder injury. You can get golfer's elbow, tennis elbow, wrist injuries, you know, but that's no different for a patient with mitochondrial disease and an able-bodied person.
We talked a little bit earlier about like the difference between like endurance exercising and resistance exercising. Would you recommend doing those on different days or could you combine them if you have the energy?
Yeah, great. Excellent question. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter is the bottom line. We did a study where we trained people where they did endurance and resistance back to back, or we did resistance and endurance. We thought that what would happen is that the gene expression profile of the last thing you did would dictate what the benefit was, but they kind of got blended together.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, whatever floats your boat, if you want to do, you know, on the same day, you could do that. Generally, though, I think most people like a bit of a break. So sometimes maybe endurance on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and maybe the resistance on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, for example. You know, that works for some people. Generally, it's fun to have a partner. Don't get somebody who's got a barbed wire tattoo and wants to, you know, grind you into the ground and bring you up to their level. You've got to, you know, have a partner who is aware at whatever level you're starting at, not to overdo it. But having a partner often helps. So somebody at the same sort of level that you are, or somebody who's very skilled, who's willing to, you know, not try to be macho and cool, but to come down and, you know, work with you at your level to get you into the activity. I know, you know, when it's minus 23 and it's horrible and windy, and I know my buddy's going to be at the corner waiting for me to go for a run, I'm more likely to get out and do it.
That accountability. Yeah. I've just been hesitant to go to a personal trainer because, like what we discussed in the past, even a nutritionist isn't very familiar with mitochondrial disease. I'd be so concerned about them pushing me in the wrong way. I don't know if you'd call it a comorbidity. I don't know what it is, but I mean, my back cannot take anything. But I would be so nervous that a trainer wouldn't direct me in the right way. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, people with chronic back pain, the best therapy is exercise. It's just got to be done properly.
Yeah, I know. I know.
But the point there, too, is like a nutritionist, most credible people, a kinesiologist or a personal trainer, you know, if they don't take interest in your disease and take it seriously and want to, you know, train you like someone with a barbed wire tattoo, then
got to move on.
But move on. We have a series that we've started. It's called the Neuromuscular Junction. If you type that in, Neuromuscular Junction with Mark Tarnopolsky, we talk about, you know, how to exercise safely. You know, most credible kinesiologists would take a look at that, as, you know, I think patients should as well.
That's a great idea.
To give people ideas.
Yeah.
And we're going to be expanding that over the next few months. It's pretty preliminary at this point, but it's called the Neuromuscular Junction with Mark Czarnopolsky. It's on YouTube. And
we'll make
some of
sure
the principles
to include it in the show notes.
Yeah. A lot of the principles are there.
Oh, great. That'll be wonderful for everyone in our community to maybe if they do want to meet with a trainer to be able to hand that to them, read it themselves, obviously, but also hand it to them and say, you know, this is what's happening in my body. You know, can you modify and make sure that I'm staying safe, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we've had so many of our patients, you know, who are really, you know, significantly impaired by whatever that might be, balance, weakness, decreased endurance. And they've got these guys with barbed wire tattoos, you know, just jacked who are used to training these meathead folks in the gym who, you know, are lovely, compassionate people. And they really take, you know, take a huge interest in helping these patients, you know, with their disability to get to the next level. So your trainer should have, you know, as much or more interest in you than they do on, you know, your average gym bro who
right.
just wants to get a little bit jacked, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully if they really like having a positive impact on their clients, that this could be a really good challenge for them, right?
Absolutely. Because yeah. there's actually more room to gain in somebody with disability. And so the relative, you know, even you might be at a very low absolute level, but the relative change is what you care about. You know, if your VO2 max is 10 and you've got Mila syndrome, you can bump that up to, you know, 14 or 15. Everything you do is just that much easier because getting up to go to the toilet, for example, is the same absolute intensity. But if it's 90% of your max, that's going to be really hard for you. If it's 60% of your max, it's going to be that much easier.
Yeah. So I think about it a lot. I think I need to maybe change my perspective or trust my body a little. I don't know, but I think about like the spoon theory and, you know, if I know that my kids have a lot going on that day that they're going to need me for, or I have to make dinner for my family, it's harder for me to grasp working out in addition to that, because I feel like by the time I'm going to get to cooking dinner, I'm not going to have the energy for it. And it's going to throw my back out and all of that. But kind of what you're saying though, is if I can improve my VO2 max, then maybe I would gain a spoon, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you can increase your VO2 max or your strength or both, ideally, then, you know, your daily activities are so much easier for you. So it puts much less stress. But, you know, you got to listen to your body, take time, and, you know, you're going to have some setbacks. We all do. Don't beat yourself up. Just get back on the horse. So many of our patients with whatever disease it is, once they get over that hump, they say, wow, you know, everything is so much easier for me now. I'm going to continue because you see the benefits.
Wow. I would love to get over that hump. I think about what I have to do in a day. And then I try to decide, okay, can I add a workout into that? Because I really try to rest in between doing things and, you know, not to make life even more difficult for myself. You know, but listening to your body is so important, and I do it all the time, and I'm sure everyone listening is nodding their head that they're also, you know, spending a good part of their day listening to their body. But this stuff is so important, and I think you're right. If you start gradually at a level that really makes sense for you, and to not, you know, immediately walk into a 60-minute workout class with your friends, you know, that's just not on the table.
No, you're going to fail, and then you'll feel bad about yourself, you know, because it's all about positivity and, you know, do something good for yourself. You know, certainly things like a quiet stationary bike. When I, you know, ripped off my hamstrings and I had a broken neck and I had to take time off running, I had a really quiet bike so I could watch Netflix or read papers. You know, for a lot of people too, you know, my wife went through whatever it is, Orange is Black or something like that, but, you know, on the stationary bike and really got into a number of things. So that definitely allows the time to pass. And it's also time for yourself, because for a lot of us too, you got kids and other things.
Yeah.
But you can just go down. I'm, you know, my wife watches some crazy show about some guy that talks about interior design and decorating. I'd rather shoot myself in the head, but for her, she really enjoys it. And, you know, it's a real treat for her to get on the bike and to watch this crazy guy talk about, you know, what to do with your colors inside your house.
Right. So I don't know if I heard you say it on another podcast or read something that you said, but, you know, about how 30 minutes everyone talks about like a 30-minute workout, and you've even said it in this podcast, I believe, earlier today. How crucial is that 30 minutes? Like, is my heart benefiting from a 10 or 15-minute aerobic workout?
Bottom line is, for everyone, I think, you know, some of these guidelines are for the general population, but even for the general population, anything's better than nothing. Most people do absolutely nothing. And we know that sedentary behavior, step counts less than 4,000 per day, increases cardiovascular mortality, increases the risk of being overweight and obese, which then makes it harder to get out of a chair, accentuates, you know, abnormal sugar levels, accentuates mitochondrial dysfunction. So anything's better than nothing. And again, like I say, our patient who was 38 seconds on the bike when she started, she got to, you know, 30 minutes three times a week or within a few months with severe and interesting mitochondrial dysfunction in myotonic dystrophy is as bad as our worst patients with the primary mitochondrial disease. We were the first to show that. So myotonic dystrophy is a mitochondrial disease. But what was interesting is we brought, because we compared our myotonic patients to able-bodied people who are age and sex match, huge decline in mitochondrial capacity. And that almost went back to normal after 3 months of endurance training. So huge, huge benefits to these individuals. But again, yes, from an epidemiological perspective, you know, when you start getting up to, you know, 30 minutes a day of moderate intensity exercise, you're lowering cardiovascular risk, lowering the risk of depression, stroke, you know, almost every cancer that's out there is lower risk if you exercise on a regular basis. But that isn't to say that less is not valuable. Okay. Anything, I think, is valuable.
What about like a brisk walk for 30 minutes?
Oh, for sure. I mean, again, the nice thing, as I say, about walking is that you are going to increase the energy requirement by using the trekking poles, and you're also going to then get a little bit of workout for your arms. So, you know, a nice brisk 30-minute trek. And also there's something about being outside too. I mean, certainly for me, being out in the woods in the forest or just walking around the park is just so lovely to be part of nature and, you know, to feel that aspect of things. So being outside is definitely helpful, but not for everyone. If it's too cold, wet, too hot, too humid. And setting something up at home, I think, is also helpful for many people, because certainly for me, at the end of a 14-hour day or something, when I go home, last thing I want to do is work out. So, you know, I get up at 5 a.m, get the workout done, so it's out of the way, so I'm not stressed about having to do it later on in the day. And then I just feel so much more happy, enthusiastic throughout the rest of the day if I've got it done first thing in the morning. But for me to get up, drive somewhere, get out, park, go to a gym, that's difficult for many people. So setting something up at home does encourage compliance, mm-hmm. and people tend to actually get it done.
For me, since I can only work out for such a short amount of time, really, I don't like the idea of driving somewhere to do it really doesn't seem to feel worthwhile.
No, and that's why, you know, setting things up at home is just so important. And, you know, when we had young kids too, one of us had to stay in the house while the other one went outside. So we set up a gym in the house so that you can get it done. And again, if you throw a bike downstairs in some smelly basement with nothing, no one wants
right,
to go down there.
Right.
So my poor wife,
you have to make it attractive.
Yeah. I feel sorry for my wife because I set it up in our living room. So we had,
but at least,
you know,
there's a TV.
And weights and everything in the living rooms. Like, I don't want anything fancy. I want something practical. And, you know, I had a nice television so you could watch whatever your favorite show
right.
is. Which
for you, it's not the home repair aesthetically pleasing shows, as you just mentioned, right? Not your cup of tea?
I watch biathlon or cross-country skiing. My wife watches the home decorating shows.
Well, there's something out there for everyone, right?
Everyone. Yep.
So, you know, we've talked about this wide knowledge base that you have. And, you know, you have so many good things to say. And I know your work, there's so many pillars of your work that you do. But when it comes to helping a patient and their family, like, what does that mean to you? I like to talk to physicians about that. I think it really helps from the patient side to hear what a physician's answer would be on something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a number of aspects to that. One is, you know, you might say, why do you go into neurology? It's a therapeutically nihilistic endeavor. there's nothing you can do. But I disagree. And I think my whole life has been about, we can do something about nutrition, exercise, and also all the small little things ultimately have a don't miss vitamin D deficiency, don't miss vitamin B12 deficiency. You know, your hair is dropping out. Well, check zinc. Oh, wow, your zinc is in your boots. You know, go on zinc. That's going to help your hair if you're deficient. So all of those little things, it's just so nice to, you know, micromanage all those little things. And then someone says, wow, this really made a difference. I mean, we had a lady who had the genetic disease called spinocerebellar ataxia type 6. And she came in, she was off balance and was falling and everything. And so we put her on a exercise balance program. So it was focusing on balance. She did Pilates and balance exercise only. And she came back 6 months later and said, my SCA is cured. She had almost no symptoms just from balance training. So things like that are just, it's so rewarding. And also we quantify things. So we have a VO2 max machine. We have a $120,000 strength device. And to have people come back and say, oh, look, you know, you started this exercise program, your strength has been dropping by, you know, whatever, 10, 12, 20% per year. And when you started this, oh, look, you plateaued. Because a lot of people say, well, I didn't improve. But plateauing for many people is a big thing. Because the more you keep dropping, the more you approach a disability threshold where, wait a sec, I can't get out of the chair. I can't, you know, get off the toilet. Now you need a personal support worker. So showing people all of these small little things is just so rewarding. And it's lovely for me to work, you know, as a team. We've got kinesiologists, we've got nurses, genetic counselors, and for everyone to be working together to teach somebody how to exercise properly, to go over diet, to make sure we don't miss any deficiencies. And then to, you know, see that people, you know, so they take ownership of their disease more versus you go in, which, you know, often happens and say, well, there's no drug for you. There's no cure. We'll see you in 5 years. Nothing you can do. Bye-bye. You'll be in a wheelchair. So we don't give people false hope. We're very realistic. And, you know, I've seen hundreds of people with different genetic disease die of horrible diseases. But we also, you know, some people, there's nothing we can do. And exercise, obviously, with the most severe disorders, you know, that's not going to help, nor is anything going to help. But supporting them in different ways is really valuable and important to us as a team. But, you know, there's so many little things you can do. And I think that's why it seems that our clinic is quite popular. And, you know, when I was threatening to retire a few years ago and was moving in that direction, you know, people were going to other neurologists who didn't have the strength device, didn't have loving and caring kinesiologists who spent their life learning how to exercise people properly, sitting down with them to, you know, go through what works for that individual. So all of those things, you know, I find, you know, incredibly rewarding. And it's also kind of neat to me as somebody who's exercised 120,000 kilometers of running in the last 40 years. You know, I take it to heart every day. I train 7 days a week. It's kind of nice to see it actually helps our patients, even with rather severe disorders. And, you know, I'm also learning from my patients. I'm an old guy now.
You know, people are, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I go to the drugstore and I get the seniors discount now, which is pretty cool. But what's interesting is, you know, all of our work does show that what helps our patients with mitochondrial disease also translates to aging. So I take the mitochondrial cocktail now. I take, you know, obviously my creatine, you know, I take my vitamin D, I take a multivitamin. I've tried to increase my protein, spread it out more throughout the day. Of course, I still train 7 days a week. I've now started to do, I hate weights, but I'm doing that 3 times a week because I'm old and skinny and, you know, trying to incorporate all those things. So it's a bit of a selfish thing as well to learn from the patients and apply it to, you know, my wife, myself, and, you know, to teach older adults how to stay healthy because aging is a mitochondrial disease that we all have.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it. Well, I am so appreciative that you've been sharing your knowledge with us the last couple of weeks. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I have many more ideas of how you will enlighten us in the future. I hope that you're willing. So thank you for your time and for your energy. And I know you balance a lot. And so giving all this great information to us over the last couple of weeks has been very appreciated on our end. And I thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Marcy, and have a great day.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.